I'm happy now to welcome back to the show Fred Nathan. He's the founder and executive director of Think New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, and thank you for having me back.
So let's talk about Think New Mexico. You are a think tank that's very much results-oriented, and I have to say I found it quite fascinating to look at your website and see the checklist of things that you've tried to get done in the past. You've actually gotten most of them done.
Well, thank you. We pride ourselves on being results-oriented, and we want to distinguish ourselves from some of the other think tanks that are out there and just generate white papers and cross their fingers and hope something good happens. And since we're not quite that optimistic, we have an office across the street from the Roundhouse, and when we have an idea, we like to see it all the way through from inception and turn it into legislation and then try to get it enacted. And with the help of a lot of people, including many of your listeners, we've been successful with most of them, and we're bringing two back this session that we hope to turn into check marks.
What are a couple, just very briefly, of the things that you've gotten done in the past?
I think we're best known for our first initiative, which was to make full-day kindergarten accessible to every child in New Mexico. After that, we spent 3 years working to repeal the tax on groceries, and last year to keep it from being reimposed. Our third initiative was to create a strategic water reserve to keep a little bit of water in our rivers. Fourth campaign was to reform the lottery to make sure that that fund did not go into bankruptcy, and we did that by cutting some of its administrative costs and redirecting those to deserving high school seniors for scholarships. And then our last campaign that we got to the finish line was on title insurance and changing, making that a more competitive system to bring the prices down for consumers to refinance mortgages and to buy a first home. Oh, and I'm forgetting the sixth campaign was on individual development accounts, which are basically designed to help working low-income people save to buy a home or to go to college or to start a micro-enterprise. So those are our six campaigns that we've gotten to the finish line.
Amazing. Now, this legislative session, we're talking about a couple of things, and we've had a quite an extensive show, when was it, not too long ago, on small schools, and we'll talk about that a little bit today if we get to it. But the one of the major legislative initiatives that you have this time around is about something called pay to play. What's that?
Well, this has been sort of a problem with state government really for a very long time. In fact, we wrote a report about corruption in New Mexico and actually traced it all the way back to Billy the Kid and the Lincoln County Wars, which was really a fight over the contract to provide beef to the Army and two rival factions that wanted that contract. And then fast forward to 2010, 2011, and we're still...
That's what Billy the Kid was about?
Partly. That was part of... he was mixed up in that. And then, you know, fast forward to today, and we're having more of this corruption related to government contracts. And so we thought maybe this is something that we ought to try to address. And because we have a bipartisan board, we thought, you know, maybe we could be a good vehicle to bring people together around some non-ideological solutions. And the one that we think would be most effective is actually something that's not terribly original by Think New Mexico, but something we seen work in other states, and that is really to eliminate the pay element from pay-to-play corruption by barring political contributions by lobbyists and those bidding on government contracts so that they can't make political contributions, and then we can have more of a level playing field where those contracts are determined and the public can be assured that they're being determined based on price and quality, as opposed to who's made the most political contributions. And we think that'd be a very good thing, not only in terms of restoring trust in government, but also bringing some of the costs down. In fact, when we came out with our report, we got a call from a gentleman in Albuquerque who has a business doing landscape architecture for state highways. And he told us that has contracts with all the surrounding states, but he's never bid on New Mexico because he didn't want to tarnish his reputation and have to get into the business of making political contributions. And so forth. So,
basically, the idea was that in order to get a contract in New Mexico at this moment in history, you have to make a political contribution?
Well, no, I think that's the perception among too many people, and I think there are probably many contracts, and I'm glad you asked that question, that are done appropriately and by the book. But there is a perception that there are some outliers where those types of things that shouldn't be considered become part of the equation. And so if we can make it clear in law that, you know, people bidding on government contracts are prohibited from making political contributions, we actually think that will bring in more business people to compete for those contracts, which should bring down the price in addition to making it a more level playing field.
So what are some examples of pay-to-play where people have paid and then they've played?
There have been a number of allegations, and I should emphasize the word allegations, that have been in the newspapers and the U.S. attorneys looked at, where it's been alleged, for example, that people in the investment business have made enormous contributions and then have received contracts to invest pension monies. That would be, I think, the one that's probably received the most attention. But, you know, it's happened in a number of different areas with allegations about Racinos and things like that and people that are politically connected. So this would restore trust and if we can remove the ability for contractors and lobbies to make contributions, then we think that would restore trust in that process and restore trust in government.
What actual legislation is introduced or going to be introduced this session to address that?
So we have a bill that we've drafted that does just that. It just changes who can make contributions. And essentially, if you're a registered lobbyist or if you are a contractor or someone who intends to be a contractor, you're prohibited from making a political contribution. And this is something... The lobbyist prohibition's been done in 7 states. The contractor prohibition's been done in 7 states. There are 2 states that have done both, Kentucky and Connecticut. Interestingly and coincidentally, right after they had enormous scandals, Kentucky had a scandal involving horse racing, and Connecticut had a scandal involving their governor, who apparently was accepting gifts and so forth from contractors. And in response to that, both legislatures banned political contributions from lobbyists and government contractors. So before we even wrote our report and wrote the legislation, we called into those states just to see how those laws were working. And the most memorable conversation I had was with a legislator in Connecticut who pointed out that she had been an opponent of the law and then had received a contribution from a lobbyist and subsequently voted on a very controversial bill, and her opponent pointed out, connected the dots between the contribution she had received from the lobbyist and how she voted, and she said, you know, those dots really didn't need to be connected because I had no idea. And so she's for this because she feels that she doesn't have to use the Rolodex portion of her brain, as she said, to try to remember who gave her how much and how that and who they represent. And she says it's just really professionalized all the discussions between lobbyists and elected officials.
If I may say, that does sound a little fishy that she can't remember who gave large amounts of money and what they wanted. But in any case, how would this all be enforced?
Probably the best way to talk about enforcement is, first of all, to talk about the current system. And your listeners may remember that a former state treasurer, Robert Vigil, was caught on videotape, actually, from someone that had been doing business with the state treasurer's office, had been doing investments, and he was videotaped accepting cash. And he was prosecuted, and the defense was that these were, in fact, political contributions, that the cash that the jury was seeing on the videotape was actually campaign contributions and not a bribe. He was indicted on 24 counts and got off on 23. And So I think that sort of points out the problem with our current system in terms of enforcement and people. The public, I think, is saying that they really don't see much difference between political contributions and bribes, and it's sort of difficult to differentiate. Here, I think it would be easy to enforce because if your people know that they're lobbyists, they know that they're government contractors, and they know if they're going to be bidding on a government contract, and I suppose in some cases maybe they would have to refund a contribution if they made a contribution not intending to ever bid on a contract and subsequently decide that they want to make a contribution. I think that would have to probably be refunded under our statute.
There is certainly a lot of waste and a lot of money to be saved if a law like this were to be enacted. Where's the waste? Where's the savings?
I think the savings mostly would come from, you know, there are, I think, many people in the state who are business people who don't compete for these contracts, but if they felt that rightly or wrongly, they feel that they're at a competitive disadvantage if they're not political players and they don't make political contributions. And where I see the savings is that I think we would bring in another group of business people to compete on these contracts, and just market principles would take over in the sense that you'd have many more people competing, and that would bring the price down for many contracts that the state bids out. And so that's where I would see the savings coming from. And that's, I think, an incidental additional benefit of this legislation, because to me the primary benefit is to just enhance the voice of everyday New Mexicans and to lessen the influence of special interests, which is really the primary goal, along with restoring trust in government. And I think any savings would be an additional benefit, and I'm confident there would be savings.
Not to mention potentially higher quality. If you have that many more bidders for a contract, you might get some better quality work.
And I think if you talk to most people in the who have government contracts or would like to have government contracts, I think 95%, 99% of them want to compete based on price and quality and not the amount of political contributions they make. And same thing with the lobbyists, and I should disclose, I am a registered lobbyist, and I think most lobbyists want to win or lose on the merits of their arguments rather than on their political connections. And I think it's really a smaller minority of lobbyists who really do their work mostly on the basis of relationships rather than on doing their homework about their legislation. And there would be winners and losers if this bill passed. I think those contractors and those lobbyists who win on the basis of their political contributions and connections would be at a disadvantage if this law passed. And that's a good thing.
And that's a good thing. Now, you mentioned that this was essentially nonpartisan. What kind of support have you had? Who's for it? Who's against it?
Well, we've gone to the leadership because we feel with legislation of this type that it would be best to come from the leadership. And so we're looking at, we've been in conversations now with Senator Stuart Ingle, who's the Republican minority leader in the Senate, and Tim Jennings, who's the Senate pro tem. And they seem very sympathetic, and we're sort of working out how to draft the bill. And I hope that we'll have it introduced by the end of this week. But I really see this as a bipartisan bill. I don't think, you know, corruption or ethics is a Republican or Democratic issue, and we're optimistic that we can keep this as a bipartisan issue that legislators from both parties can get behind.
We have just a few minutes left. The other thing that you are working on this year is school size. What kind of legislation are you introducing?
Well, there's a lot of evidence from around the country and in New Mexico that smaller, and I should say more moderate size schools get better results in terms of high school graduation rates and student performance and parental involvement, which is, I think, a key component of all this. So we're New Mexico is somewhat unique in that we're one of the few states where the state pays a big share of the cost of new school construction. And the way it's currently done, there's no part of that that looks at educational outcomes. And so we're simply saying with this formula that we ought to add a component so that we're not building high schools bigger than 900 or elementary schools and middle schools larger than 400 based on what the data tells us about getting results. And so what we would really do is create a small credit of about 10% to encourage districts when they come to the state for help with building a new school that they build them at a more moderate size level rather than some of these very large jumbo sized high schools that we have in some of the bigger districts with 2,000 kids in high schools. And we have elementary schools in the state with more than 1,000 kids, and those schools feel more like factories than educational institutions.
If not prisons. Mm-hmm. There's been an argument that there are economies of scale in having big schools. Is that true?
To a degree it is. That, for example, we were talking about this earlier, that if you have four small schools and each one of them has a principal, it would be more economical to have one very large school with a single principal. There are also diseconomies of scale in those larger schools. For example, APS, the Albuquerque Public Schools, spends over $5 million a year to police their schools. And if you look at where those officers are deployed, they're in these very large high schools of 2,000, 2,200 kids. Smaller schools, you'll see, don't have security guards because they're self-policing. Another example is...
I have to say, there's also a moral element in there in the sense that it's really questionable whether young people should be surrounded by men with guns that are potentially pointed at them at any moment.
I would agree, and I think in a state that's just scrambling for dollars for education, it's just tragic to be spending it on security officers rather than teachers. A second diseconomy of scale has to do with administrative costs. Some of these large schools actually take more to administer. For example, there's a high school in Albuquerque called the Rio Grande High School that had a huge problem this year where they couldn't open the school because of scheduling problems. They had to take 100 employees from their central administrative office to go down to the school and to work out the schedules for each student. And then the superintendent, Winston Brooks, appointed a sixth assistant principal for scheduling.
Good
and, of course,
heavens.
Smaller schools don't need that extra layer of administration. So you can run smaller schools very efficiently in terms of operational costs, and we know we can get better results. Two recent studies, which your listeners can find on our website, one was done by Capital Reports, where they simply looked at the highest graduation levels by high school in New Mexico and the lowest graduation levels. The highest graduation levels were overwhelmingly small schools. The highest dropout rates were overwhelmingly large schools. So that's data from right here in New Mexico. And then the Albuquerque Journal just endorsed our legislation, which is Senate Bill 2, with an editorial, which you can find on our website. And they pointed out they had profiled three different elementary schools over the last 18 months that dispel this myth that low-income children can't achieve at high levels. And the one common denominator that they noticed is that all three of those schools were smaller schools and fit within the size limits that we're looking at.
Fred Nathan is founder and executive director of Think New Mexico. They can be found on the web at thinknewmexico.org. And if people want to find out how to participate in the legislative process, they can go to your website and find out more.
And click on our Action Center, which makes it very easy to contact your legislators and the governor and tell them whatever you want to tell them.
Fred Nathan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.